Please, sir, may I have some more Brain Trust podcast? Sure you can, bud. Because that's what this is. I'm Adam Vess, and I design tabletop games in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Fuck yeah, little dude. I'm ready to give you some. My name is Will Yobes, and I'm a tabletop game designer in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Get out of here. Don't come back.
This show ain't for little British kids.
Little British kids ain't allowed. It's a tuppence fare to get into this podcast.
I think this is the one. I think this is the hit, the new intro.
A little boy is asking for a podcast, and it does paint us in a pretty good light, I'm going to say.
Yeah. We gave him the podcast that he asked for.
Come the meek, come the needy, for we have the podcast for you. I have a scene starter for you. That was my experience yesterday.
Before you do that, let's send everybody over to braintrust.rocks. That's our website now. And it goes to our Ko-Fi, where you can donate or become a subscriber to get bonus content, exclusive stuff. You can go to both of our publishing websites to get our games. You can join the Braintrust Discord server, all at braintrust.rocks. All right, now start a scene.
I was at IKEA yesterday during what was surprisingly the busiest day at IKEA I've ever seen.
I've never been to a chill day at IKEA.
But that makes me feel better. I was completely overwhelmed by the end. I bought some bowls from IKEA. I had them delivered to me by UPS, which we can call Oops now, because Oops, they broke all the damn bowls.
That must be nice, though. I mean, not the breaking, but I feel like any IKEA I've ever been to doesn't even offer delivery or shipping.
Wow. Well, the ones in Canada do. I don't know what's different. Maybe because Canada is so spread out. they just need couriers. But I brought it back to the replacement section, which you have to walk through. For me, I had to walk through the entire store to get to, which was like... in a movie, when you like are introduced to the geography of somewhere you're later going to have a climactic final fight in, it's kind of like what the vibe was. I get up to the return section and I click a button and it says, in 45 minutes, it'll be your time to return something. And then so 45 minutes is basically an impossible amount of time to fill in an IKEA. It is not short enough and it is not long enough. What are you going to do with 45 minutes?
Eat a lot of meatballs. You know what? They have this like sparkling pear juice that is exceptionally good. I don't know what it is. I love
what
it.
What are they putting in here? Probably lingonberries. Yeah, I ended up getting like a sleeve of cookies. They have those cookies there.
I don't know that I've ever had a cookie from IKEA, but I back it.
You back it.
I've never had bad food things there.
For how proudly they advertise these hot dogs.
I've never had a hot dog. They just started doing vegan meatballs like a couple years ago, so I did have those and enjoy that. And obviously the pear. Shout out to all the pear.
Bears out there. Anyway, yeah. Having to walk to the end of the store to get this thing and then walk back and then walk back and then walk back as Seb was making their way through the store like a normal human being, I was going against the flow. And I was having to walk places quickly in IKEA, which is also like antithetical to IKEA. IKEA wants you to, like, laconically, you know, move around, kind of go with the flow. But wow, I'm still recovering. It was, like, it drained my social battery in a way I didn't know existed.
I only just recently learned the difference between a maze and a labyrinth. A maze has dead ends and a labyrinth is a path.
Oh, nice.
And, you were the Minotaur cursed inside of IKEA.
Yeah, the Daedalus was UPS smashing my balls like a like a grim portent. They're like, you're going to, I'm. We are setting in motion a series of events that will make a pretty interesting Friday for you, or Thursday. But yeah, went to IKEA. I got a little shark. That's what's new with me. What's new with you?
Oh, nothing at all. Still playing Baldur's Gate. Still doing my thing. I feel like, I mean, I recognize how much that has killed my energy and productivity.
It's also, for the listener, it's also still the vacation times right now.
I will say, oh, I'm going to go do this one battle. A folly. And especially like, oh, I have somewhere to be in an hour. I'm going to just play for an hour. You have never in your life only played for an hour.
Yeah, you have to really be like a monastic ascetic monk to do that.
I'll set alarms and stuff and it still doesn't. Oh, just this. I got to finish this battle. I got to get to a save point. Like, the stuff you would tell your parents when they would tell you dinner was ready. Oh, I can't save right now.
I'm in the battle. The Pokemon generation, it had really done some damage on us, didn't it? Not being able to save in a battle.
Yeah.
That's huge. What do you think about save points in tabletop games?
I put them into Cyber Metal all over.
This is a tech lab. Very quick tech lab.
Yeah, I put save points in Cyber Metal both as like a save scum and like bullet point, let's pick up our adventure here.
Nice.
The idea that like you plug in to hardwired computers that are going to be on adventure maps and stuff to update your software, and when you do so, you're leaving a note for yourself. That is the save scum. That is, if I die in this next battle, I can reload right here. Remember what I was doing or what my goals were and just pick up and go.
I think that's another reason why Cyber Metal is the GOAT, but like being able to communicate to your new self is so sick.
I love that too, because like it could be wisdom like you find in video games where you find a note, you know, or whatever that's giving you lore or a direction to go in. But it could also just be like, I think after you die a certain number of times, you get very flippant with it. And
yeah,
it would just be like, if you're reading this, I fucked up again, like no help at all. And then you're just like cursed to make the same mistakes a little bit.
I'm pretty early in Baldur's Gate, but I don't think there's a fight that I've ever just done without reloading at least once.
I have, but I feel bad sometimes, or like I get a result that I wish I didn't get, and then I'm just like, all right, I'm going to roll for it. I try really hard not to.
Okay, so I'm not going to save scum an ability check,
sure,
but I will save scum a battle. If I'm like, okay, the surprise rounds in Baldur's Gate, do we need to call someone to double check the rules on surprise rounds in D&D? Should we? Oh my god. Seb's playing too and also has a problem with the non-lethal shit in this game. You ever come across a human being you don't quite want to read their rights and send them to hell? You ever see anybody like
that? I'm playing an evil, not Dark Urge, but I'm playing a pretty evil run, so I don't mind killing people. I've actually made decisions in the game that make me feel like a bad person in real life.
Wow.
But, Alex, my partner, is playing a non-lethal.
Non-lethal, it's not meant for it. Like, they shouldn't have it in the game. It is so chunky and clunky. If I can do a magic spell, if I, like, have power over the elements and the weave and I can make magic with my hands, I should be able to ask that magic not to kill somebody.
Like, oh, can you not? I mean,
I don't think you can.
There's a thing in the weapon wheel. I'm playing on console, so I'm not sure if this is...
I think it's physical weapons only.
Oh. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't really experimented. I mean, my game, I don't use it, so...
Yeah.
But anyway, as I was saying, it consumes me. I find that, like, if I play at all after dinner hours, like that's the rest of my night. And I don't love that. I'll think about it in bed. I definitely don't love that.
Oh, I hate the Tetris effect for games. It happens to me if I play like past 3 hours of a game in a day.
Yeah.
I will get the Tetris effect where like you see it when you close your eyes. And for some games, it is so funny seeing it because I'm like, wow, I'm just looking at planes in the sky right now.
As another Brain Trust classic callback, I would get it from Lost. I would spend so much time thinking about the television show Lost that it would like encroach my brain. And then I'd have weird dreams about not that I was on the island or anything, that I was just watching an episode. I've seen so many episodes of Lost that don't exist in my mind, in my dreams.
Somebody called the DSM-5 people. We've got a new one. We got a live one here.
815 itis.
Lostopia. Yeah. 315 itis is good. We having to go back. That's what it is. I think I'm mentally ill for a reason. So save points, I feel like I want to see more save points in games. Cyber Metal does it so incredibly well that I think you can just even steal one part of Cyber Metal's for your game and it'll make it more interesting. Like having a diegetic thing. And it makes me think like what that could be in a less technological setting, like what that kind of looks like.
I think like in fantasy, it's camping. Like that's the intent of the, and I think that's the thing to tie these together. Baldur's Gate does that nicely, that I think in my actually playing of Dungeons and Dragons, I don't have that, where it does feel like a, let's take a breath, let's reassess, and we'll go out tomorrow.
Yeah.
In play, that's often where you roll for like night random encounters and you need to set watch and like do all that stuff. And I feel like that makes it feel less like a save point or less like a rest and more like just another
risk.
Chapter. It is a risk, yeah.
But my God. My early D&D games were plagued by doing that to players, and I realize how absolutely bad form that is.
It's funny because when I had to ask the Brain Trust too, I was like, what do I, like, these battles are really hard. Am I doing something wrong? And someone's like, you can rest whenever you want.
Go to sleep, dude.
And I was like, yeah. Oh, that's kind of almost antithetical to my play experience at the table, but I understand. Yeah, it's weird because like think about just in real life, if you went up to somebody and be like, hey bud, I set a bed for you, you want to take a nap? There's a 60% chance that someone's going to try to stab you, but you could just get some shut eye. And I'm like, whoa, I don't think I really want to take that chance. I think I'd just rather stay up and then go insane.
I've heard this element of coziness in games. I'm not talking about cozy games. I'm talking about this aspect of coziness. And one great example is the bonfire in Dark Souls. Because when you're around that bonfire, nothing can hit you. You are in a safe moment. That's a hearth kind of thing. When you leave, good luck, brother. Good luck out there, you maidenless asshole. But when you're on the hearth, when you're in the camping mode, you can talk to people, you can manage your inventory, you can do all this stuff. And it's a tension release moment. And I think that's a good save point aspect.
Yeah, I think that's something that you and I both put into our trad games innately, at least like try to. But yeah, even in a world that's on fire and you have to like, you have to have moments of respite, or even, you know, for players and for characters, or else it's just, I feel like those moments often just kind of humanize the experience in a way, allow you to connect to the reality of your characters in a way of just like, fuck, what, this fucking is a lot. Like, yeah, it's the same as like, you know, if you're working and there's a rush, when you're in the rush, you're in tunnel vision. You're like going. And the second that rush goes over, you and the other coworkers are just like, damn, dude. And you need those damn dude moments in games to just sort of connect you to the world and also just give you like kind of a reset, like lets you blink and let the world kind of move around you a little bit.
Yeah, I also find that like player characters are just inherently in adventure games. These are people in crisis. And if you never see them at any point other than managing like a crisis situation, no matter what it is, you're missing all that depth that you're talking about. And yeah, that's just a great idea. I'm definitely going to consider this. I think this is system design. This is game design. But I think a lot of this is adventure design, because to talk about the adventure design of Baldur's Gate and the encounter design, I've got a lot of things to say here. I'm playing it very slow, you know, like only doing an encounter and then hopping off. But no Baldur's Gate encounter, at least in the first act, chases you beyond the encounter. You have this like doneness to it. Like you are done and you can disengage and you can decide what to do next.
Yeah. And I think that's how you and I play too. We often will like resolve an instance and then be like meta check in, like, do we want to pick this up next week or whatever, you know, like, because those moments, whether they be narrative or tactical or whatever, those moments are the bullet points of your story, and you need something in between them to just like make things make sense. If everything's a bullet point, if everything's nonstop and there's no breaks and there's no breath, like, one, it's going to all blur together and kind of be, in my opinion, unsatisfying as a player, because,
yeah,
like you said, there's a disconnect between what you're experiencing and what is going on in your head. And then also, like, even just think about, we talk a lot about like TV shows and even, you know, Lost, it still has episodes where they're building a golf course because, like, they're humans, right? They're people. They don't even have to be human, but they're people who live in a world, and they're, and survival is not the only human need.
Right. Yeah. Let's tackle more of Maslow's hierarchy.
We have in our home a list on our fridge of needs that was made by a therapist that was just like so much more than you think. It's like, yes, shelter and food and whatever, but like your ability to express yourself, your ability to understand things, like
I want to know more about this list.
I'll try to take a picture, maybe throw it in the show notes, but it's like there's got to be like 50-60 things on this list, because in Maslow it's what, 5 things or something, and they're boiled down to their essence. There is like having a sense of self, having an expression of self or of sexuality or of gender. Those are our needs because they make you who you are. And if you are not fulfilling those, or if you're neglecting those needs, you can feel incomplete or dysphoric or have discomfort in some way. So I think that, yeah, that might be actually something worth gamifying. This sounds... I was thinking it too. But
I was like, how do you tune that to be specifically for a setting?
Even just recognizing it,
type of player character.
Looking at the list as a game designer and saying, oh, our game meets these needs for, you know, entertainment and whatever, you know, like the characters are engaging in conflict resolution, but are the characters engaging in like connective things at all to them and their world, or them and other people, because those are things that people need in society. And
I'm gonna absolutely need a copy of this for Big Grave. that is definitely it. Wow,
we'll add. Yeah, it's helpful for me too. I mean, like, it's on our fridge, so I see it when I get a seltzer or whatever, but like every once in a while I'll just kind
seltzer's on there.
So I wrote seltzer on there. No, it's it's handy just as like a check-in thing too, mentally, to be like, I'm focusing a lot on X, Y, and not Z. And like, maybe I can just take a minute while I sip this seltzer to think about that or whatever.
That's really nice.
But yeah, so I think that is sort of the zoomed out, like, what is the function of rest and a save point? It is to address other needs. And that is both in a player and in a character sense of like, the character is in this world, and so they have needs that are skewed by the setting and their company. And we as players have needs in terms of like am I tapped out? Am I burnt out from playing? Am I playing too long? Am I like ready? Am I energized? Is this exciting for me? Yeah. Like,
I like how you're drawing the players into the save point check-in. Like, you're considering the characters' ideas, but also what the players might need.
I mean,
which
just,
is great.
Just off the top of my head, and then we can get into today's topic. But even if you say, like, here's this this list of 60, we're going to put maybe 10 of them as, like, a checklist in our game, and then say, like, you know, this is a downtime activity. At every downtime, choose one or two of these items on your checklist for your character to address, either mentally or interactively in the world. And then once it's checked, like, you do a different one next time.
Nice.
So every time you're playing, every time you're having a campfire in game, you're doing, and Baldur's Gate does this a little bit with your ability to talk to your companions and stuff and, like, manage your inventory, and you can even, like, adjust your looks at camp. This is a way to put that into tabletop experience that is informed by psychology, like, in a somewhat scientific way, that says these things are important to you whether you think they are or not. Or you know, like, you might look at an item on the list and decide your character is not as concerned with that and just kind of, like, brush it off. And that's still fine,
yeah,
but it requires you to address it and question it. And I think that might be really light, really easy, pluggable tech for any kind of game that's going to make everything feel more personal and engaged, because in that sort of meta way that I think we chase often, it's going to teach your players in a way, hey, bud, just take a second and think, like, are your needs being met today? And I think that's an important question to ask that a lot of people don't make time to ask.
Right. It might not come up. I have, like, taken these ideas and essentialized them in Big Grave, the fashion fantasy, where you have two measures of, like, your character's situation. It is the state of your items and the state of your slots. So there are four slots in the game, big, pop, over, and under. The big is the thing they notice first. The over is the piece that sets the vibe. The under is the thing closest to you. And the pop is the thing that ties it all together. And in each one of those slots, you can hold an item, which is a piece of clothing or accessory or vibe or whatever. And during a style showdown, you can get your clothing fucked up. And that's called stitching. It rips. It otherwise doesn't work for you. And if you get enough of your clothing fucked up, you break one of your slots, which throws your very sense of self and identity and style into question. And you have to manage these resources, and you can recharge them by doing a version of the game has recharge actions that are specific to each kind of class in the game. So one will be like fixing your items is connecting, doing something to connect with your community or other people. And fixing a slot is doing something to connect back to yourself. So that could be like smoking a cigarette alone on the roof. And that's just what you do. And that's a scene starter for that kind of thing. Or it could be like go volunteer at a community organization, something to fix one of your pieces. Maybe someone can physically help you fix that piece. Or you just kind of recontextualize yourself in this world.
Yeah, I think that is kind of the function of a save point in a less meta way, is examining your character's place in the world and how they might want to change it in the next scene or session or whatever.
Yeah. Save points. This is a sneak episode about save points.
Yeah, let's hit Apple S right here. Command S. And get into... Is this also a tech lab that we want to talk about today?
What do we talk? Let me look at the spreadsheet. I should have looked at this. Because it's not a game design technology. We're talking about research today. What would we call this?
I don't have the spreadsheet open.
Oh my god, Google, Google Drive. I opened it and it populated the episode idea Brain Trust spreadsheet first, saying you often open this around this time.
Whoa, you're not wrong.
You're not wrong. I do. We record on Friday. I started editing this podcast on 1.3 speed.
I can't imagine doing it at 1. So like
I did it for one for years.
I listened to our show at 1. We can get a little long-winded.
Yeah. I've got some like super hacks to like kill more of the dead space. Like this section, for example. Okay. So this could be, you know, RPG troubleshooting, therapy, help desk.
Help desk. I think this is
help desk.
This, yeah, it's help. It's help. It's meta. It's like not in fiction. It's here's something to think about that might help you in your process. And I don't think it's exclusive to game stuff.
Help desk, how to research your RPG. Let's start by talking about what we even mean by research. What has research meant to you in the past?
To me, research is thematically and mechanically ingesting everything I can, then pulling out the bones of the things I don't like, and then digesting the good stuff and pooping out my game.
I don't think I've ever heard you say poop before.
Alex makes fun of me because I say the O's. I say long O, poop.
Instead of like puke.
But yeah, I think my main thing with research is I consume as much as I can in terms of movies and other games, and the games could be related or unrelated. You know, they don't have, like, I'm doing research for Bloodborne right now, but I'm researching games that don't have anything to do with vampires or urban fantasy or anything, in addition to games that do. You know, like researching Thousand-Year-Old Vampire, because it's about vampires, even though the gameplay, the experience is extremely different than a Morkborg or a traditional game.
Yeah, you know, any vampire game is now in conversation with
yes.
Thousand-Year-Old Vampire and Vampire the Masquerade.
Yes.
Like, you're acknowledging, you're finding where the conversation is on this thing and kind of managing where your reader's expectations are and making sure that you can place your work in that conversation.
Exactly. Like, it's not what can I rip off or what can I avoid to fall into the same things. It's what's being said here, what interesting take do I have to say, or what, even if it's redundant, like, especially with vampires, which have been a thing for hundreds of years, like, the base of information is so deep that I have to just cut and paste and find a status quo that I can live with and then build off of.
Yeah. This is great. This, like, placing yourself in the conversation. I have had a conversation. I have talked to game designers before who explicitly don't research and treat that as a point of pride to consume none of the previous scholarship in RPGs into making something. And you can tell by, I am not naming names and I am not getting any more specific, but that I do not like this practice and I don't think it's successful. There is a John Waters quote about, someone asks him like, hey, how do you make movies? And he was like, participate, watch movies, watch good movies with the sound off, watch bad movies, watch terrible stuff. Just participate in the art form. And I think that's exactly what you're saying. Reading, playing, consuming, that kind of stuff. I think for me, I think back to games like Guide to Casting Phantoms that we made together and Black Mass, and the games I've made that have a big historical backbone, that I will do lots of like academic library history research. And I go by the numbers that for every page you write, of, you know, historical inspired stuff, you have to read 300 pages. of something, of like firsthand accounts or things like that, which is pretty huge. And I understand that that's not accessible for lots of folks. But for me, I find that when you are hitting that level, and that 300 pages could be spread across many different mediums. It doesn't just have to be, you know, nonfiction. You develop a freedom and a comfort and a, not mastery, but a stylistic point of view for this that you might not have if you don't do that.
I think that can take different forms too, because I think you I think you enjoy the historical aspect.
Yeah.
And I know I don't. Like, that was a thing with Guide where I was like, you do that, I'm not going to do that. But
go for it.
But I still, like, am interested conceptually. So part of Cybermetal when I was doing research was reading cyberpunk stuff, watching cyberpunk movies and stuff. But also, like, because I call that game scumbag role-playing, or, like, you're just regular people, like, just living in the city that the game is based on is a form of research. And in
being
active and present in my city and looking at things while I'm driving, like buildings that you take for granted and stuff, and then integrating that into the world, or taking photos that I would then use as textures and maps and stuff in the game. Like, that was all active research, but it was just part of my everyday life as well.
Yeah. So, like, the whole write what you know thing.
Yes.
That, because you are there, you're in the community, you're physically in the space. That research number, that 301, sounds extremely intimidating until you've, like, learned that the corollary to write what you know and is learn what you don't know.
Yeah.
And that kind of learning is finding all of the blind spots. You're not, you know, a Wikipedia skim is going to help you for your home game and your home session, but when you are opening your work up to a larger audience, even if it's like a few dozen people or a few hundred, you're going to really wish you investigated your blind spots for this stuff and found a variety of voices to listen to. And it can be about many, it does, not just like a historical ancient Rome game. Like, this could be your pirate game or your fantasy game. You know, you can have things in fiction that are real and lived in, and you'll be able to paint with a much deeper texture by doing this research. So what are some ways that you create a reading list or like a vibe list of things to check out? And what's your process when you are investigating those things?
So I actually just recently bought like a little wheelie cart for my office. One, because it fits perfectly in this vacant space, but I'm using it as organization physically for research stuff for Bloodborg. The top shelf is just things that have come in, like Kickstarters and stuff that I haven't read. So they're just to read. They're not necessarily related to this project. I've got some tools, like my wood-burning tool, in there for fast access because it's next to my desk. But then below that, the second shelf, is these are books that I'm plucking from my greater bookshelf for specifically Bloodborg research. So Morkborg's in there. Thousand-Year-Old Vampire's in there. Urban Shadows is in there. Just anything that I think tangentially or directly will influence my writing and design. Even like Vaults of Varn is in there, and that's a game I've never played that's not about vampires. It has like very little in common, but it is just a celebrated adventure game with some cool flavor and stuff, so it's in there.
That's like a scholarship. That's like a style. What am I trying to say? You're targeting that as
a vibe
something
research
in the conversation. Yeah, exactly.
And I think at this stage, too, I'm not discerning at all. If I think I might pluck something or I might be inspired by something, it goes in this area. And I would say almost all of my games research takes place in this way, because I have just like a pretty big collection. So I can pull it off of my bookshelf into this area and have the physical thing. If there's something digital that I really want, I will print it as a booklet and then put it in that physically, because my research for the most part takes place offline. I think that's like
nice.
An important focus thing for me. But then say I've curated this, and then even I'll put like art books in there. I'll put things that are just vibes, Crap Hound or whatever. Then as I digest that, I will read them, but I will also take notes. And sometimes the notes are, oh, on page whatever, there's a cool thing about dying. And sometimes the notes, when I, like, for example, with Morkborg, I wrote down basically the table of contents in my notebook and said, like, here's all the things that make this game. Here's where their priorities lie in terms of whether it's, like, page expense or how much, like, real estate they take or what the sequence is or whatever. And here's what I can kind of expect to turn that into in my lens to make sure I'm not missing things, to make sure the information is delivered in an expected and familiar way. Because that table of contents is my first thing that I write.
Yeah.
It's fluid, so go ahead.
I'm going to throw up a huge alarm bell. This is the John Waters participate in the conversation moment. This is watching the movie with the sound off. You are outlining a book that's already completed and writing the goals of each section of the book and how the book achieves it. And that is one of the biggest ways to learn about book structure and the meaningful design of a book as a unit of art. And that's something I certainly wanted to talk about. You can do it with any game that you like that you haven't done something like this with. Just take a look. How does Apocalypse World structure? How is it pacing out this information? We kind of think about this in the micro as game designers of like, how quickly can you make a character in the book? What books don't have you make the character right away? Why are they like this? Like, what are the different goals and different purposes of this stuff? Like, I think as game designers, we have a lot of unfounded dogma that we have brought in from like secondhand conversations that we can just go into these works and decide for ourselves what is going to work for us in this situation.
Yeah, this is a process that I go through every time I make a new game book. Like, I'm doing it over again.
Yeah.
Because different books have different goals, different settings have different voices. You know, there are all these different factors. So then as a sort of sidearm to this, I'll say that's my like technical and mechanical research. My thematic and flavor research for me is almost exclusively movies, because that's just where I engage with media the most and most, I understand it. I enjoy it. It's like, that's my thing. So for Bloodborg, I already have like a letterboxed list of vampire stuff. Some of them I've seen and some of them I haven't. Some of them are more obvious, like, I guess, traditionalist vampire stuff, like Interview with the Vampire. And others are...
like Hammer Dracula stuff.
Yeah. And then there are other, like, different takes on vampirism, like A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night or My Heart Can't Beat Unless You Tell It To, like, because they're still about... conceptually a similar thing, but they say different things about it. And there's movies on that list that I don't really even love, but that I put on there because they are in the conversation. Like we keep saying, like a movie like Bliss that I think conceptually is really cool and then kind of like fell a little bit flat in execution for me, but the concept is cool enough that I actually am very inspired by that, and to the extent that I called in my prequel adventure, they're the Cult of Bliss, that are like people who are bringing about or engaging with early vampirism, because I wanted it to feel intoxicating in the way that movie is. So I guess I call it, you know, my left brain, my right brain. I have my technical, mechanical what makes a game book? Why is information the way that it is? How is it dictated to its audience in a way that is effective? And then what is a vampire on the other side? How, like, why are vampires cool or not cool? What makes that world compelling to be a part of as a player and as a viewer? And what is special, or what things do I have to address in terms of, like, can they go out in the sunlight? Are they allergic to garlic? Whatever. Like, again, that's because vampires have a different lore, a deeper lore than, like, when I was doing cyber metal and I could be more flippant with techie stuff. Vampires have, players have baggage. People have an understanding or an expectation of what a vampire is. So I have to either meet that expectation or deliberately skew it. And that's something I can't leave to chance or randomness. To achieve my goals, I need to be explicit about those things. So there's, and you know, there's crossover in terms of, like, a game book about vampires or a movie about, you know, SLC Punk or something, like, yeah, which is on my list in terms of just, like, shithead role playing. Those things cross over, but that's generally my approach, is ingest, keep the streams, just keep them moving. I don't even care if they're separate all the way, or I just need to be immersed in vampire thinking and game thinking, and that will inspire me. That will be my Tetris when I go close my eyes. I'm thinking about,
yeah,
you know, what is a vampire's role in society? And that leads to cool ideas, and then I can develop them later mechanically or whatever. But I'm right now, again, built literally and, like, figuratively in my mind, building the table of contents, building the list of goals I want my game to achieve and address and ignore, both in terms of vampirism and adventure and where those things meet.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, you're getting to know the topic so in and out that you can feel free in creating it.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you have a game that doesn't have a previous body of genre to work with? So I'm working on Big Grave right now, Big Grave Fashion Fantasy. The closest things that I can tell you that this game is like is dress-up games, Paradise Killer, and Weird Cities. And the research list basically has to account for the lack of, like, primary material I have to adapt. Like, it's not a work of adaption. It is a work of creating new things and building the expectations that players will have to play within and finding out what that stuff is. And that's a really fun process to create the reading list for me, because the stuff really is not often in movies, and the nonfiction, there's no nonfiction to check out. Well, and the video games are
sorry, it's funny, but I think, I mean, when I, you know, first heard of Big Grave and when we play tested it, I think of, like, Paris is Burning. I think of Drag Race, like,
yes, yeah.
And there isn't, in the same way, like, you know, a library of games about dressing your character in particular ways, or, like, finding power or confidence in the way that you physically present. But Paris is Burning was weirdly a huge inspiration for cyber metal as well.
Nice.
Just the idea of competition that was not based in violence, and subculture that's almost is divorced from culture in a way. Like, it exists in this pocket, in this bubble, and develops and evolves in its own way. And I think in a way that Big Grave World does that in your mind. You're constantly, like, you know, I think Big Grave is also a cool example of, like, where music could sort of influence aesthetic in terms of just, like, pure vibe. You're mechanizing and describing and elaborating on this ethereal energy into a setting, into mechanics. And so while it's not as obvious as me watching Interview with the Vampire, I think you just like, this is more equivalent to me just living in city as research, like you exploring the vibes that you want to elicit, whether that be musically, just live in life, like, because it's an adventuring.
To spoil it.
Yeah.
My solution that I came up with this, you know, months ago was to find the most stylistic writing I could possibly ingest and take in like stylistic language, because that was going to be my way to communicate to the players, and to find like these stylistic descriptions of strange cities and people's practices in those cities, and to create like a very human level thing like that. So taking in these books, like I'm working through Dahlgren by Samuel Delaney, which is exactly this kind of thing I'm looking for. And my research is taking passages and saving them and reflecting on them and finding out what is working on a language level, talking to my friends who I think are just really great writers and seeing what they have to say about what is stylistic writing and what is, you know, what is kind of the research for the tone and language that is going into this game.
For sure.
Because the design is so set that I am... I just have to make everything else as good and as pared down and as, you know, straightforwardly cool as the design. And yeah, it's a cool process. And I think we've exemplified like two different tacks to take for researching something, a game like this.
Yeah. Just to sort of, hammer down on what you said earlier too, I think not researching on purpose is, not great idea.
Pretty weird.
I mean, you think about like Steal Like an Artist by Austin Kleon or Everything's a Remix, or like the whole nature of the creative process is that taking things in through your lens and spitting things out through your lens, right? Like by going through the sort of circuitry of your brain and your being and then putting it back out, you're creating something new, and but you're standing on the shoulders of giants, right? Like even if you make your fantasy Heartbreaker and you say, I'm never going to read D&D or do whatever, like you're still, like you said, you're making a game that's in conversation with those, and yeah. A conversation can't be fruitful if you're ignoring people who are talking to you.
Yeah,
it's going to only benefit you. And I guess I get that you like maybe subliminally don't want to bite something, but
if you're so worried about that, there are larger problems with your process
for sure
than research.
But all creative work, painting, music, composition, writing, everything is derivative of the things that came before it, and nothing has intrinsic value. Nothing is intrinsically special. It's special because it's your voice participating in the lexicon of art. And you only do yourself a disservice by blocking out things that might affect your opinions. Like you said, John Waters was saying, watch bad movies. Like, you learn just as much from things that you don't like.
I have read a Reddit thread that had, what are your least favorite RPGs of all time? And I found the ones that I was interested in that seemed to be close to like the book structure of Big Grave. And I'm going to read exactly why people didn't like those things and see where the pitfalls are. Like,
yeah,
that's a huge part.
I mean, again, like, with the Souls, like too, you can see the ghosts before you fuck up and die. Are you going to be like, oh, I'm not paying attention to that ghost, because, and then you fuck up and die. Like, it only benefits you to learn where those trappings are, or to see where successes happen, or to be inspired by someone else's ideas. Like, it doesn't mean you're stealing them, as long as you're not stealing them. And even that is a vague, you know, that's like, again, I don't think an idea is often or always someone's, right? Like this kind of, this is getting in some weird spiritual shit of like collective consciousness and the idea that like a thought kind of exists until someone grabs it.
Right.
Yeah, just join in. Like, be part of that collective and you just learn more. You learn more easily and you are constantly sharpening your own blade for iteration, for coming up with ideas and being able to recognize when you have an idea and which ideas are good or bad or worth pursuing or might not interest you. You're just always, I mean, I think this is just like a big thing for who I am as a person is like, I always want to learn new shit.
Yeah.
And the way that I do that typically is through art and through physical, like creating media. You know, I just bought a wood burning tool with no experience of wood burning because I want to try it and see how it feels physically and what it feels like creatively and how it differs from the experience I get drawing or painting, because it's its own thing that kind of results in a similar thing that is a physical piece of art. But like, that's just always who I've been and who I continue to be and want to be, is someone who is constantly inspired by and wants to participate in a creative world.
Yeah, and I think I have an exercise for the listener that I've picked up from the Draftsman podcast, which is about art and making art. And they have this concept called your art parents. And for any piece that you're making or any style exploration, you pick two figures in the art world, whether they are pieces themselves or artists themselves or movements, and you hold them in your mind while creating this thing to create something new. And so their advice goes something like, take something old and take something new, and your combination of them will create something that is your own. And something you can do for projects you're working on is even just deciding on two art parents is great. What are your game parents?
I was just going to say, this is cringe, but I immediately know who they are. And it's Jason Morningstar of Bully Pulpit Games, the creator of Fiasco, which was kind of my eye-opening story game just experience, and Johan Noor of Morkborg, who to me ushered in this world of let your freak flag fly, be the most you possible.
Yeah.
Not everything has to be what you expect it to be, curation as artistry. That aesthetic that I can look at my own body of work too and being like, here are things I was just making and here are things that are me. And like those came from that permission, that implicit permission I got from the success of Morkborg and that work that Johan does, that is do your thing and people will enjoy that because it's yours.
Yeah. And it can be per game, right? And it probably should be per game.
For sure.
But you can have ones like largely guide you. But I think Plasmonics is a really easy one. I talk about it in the beginning of the game. It is Gamma World, first edition Gamma World, and Into the Odd, and Cybermetal. And so how are these games smashing into each other and creating something new? Like, how am I using the medium of Into the Odd to pull out what I want from Gamma World? And how is Cybermetal delivering a flying kick to it at the same time? And so that can be a guiding light for you, like being able to switch through these perspectives and be like, okay, how am I demaking one game into another? If you're doing a project like Plasmodics, it's really great to think of everything as a possibility within the original text that you are going to infect with your own art. And for Plasmodics, it came in the form of cryptic alliances as a concept. The mutations themselves are similar in name only, and literally every part of the mutation is different and more strange and weird and more me. It's a very freeing process, and it helps you build, by that research, it helps you build a plan for making something, which is kind of what research is supposed to do. It helps you make a plan to get something to be done.
Yeah. And it gets you excited to do it.
Yeah, and it should be fun.
That's the, yeah, that's the other thing. And that's why I didn't do it with Guide, but I'm loving doing it for Cyber Metal and stuff, is like, I know the sort of things I'm interested in. I want to watch movies all the time, and I digest them in a way that, truthfully, Fiasco helped teach me, is how to analyze media into gameable chunks and gameable moments, and that's the research I like. So me having this list of movies, it doesn't feel like a burden. I'm excited to watch every one of those movies. And if I learn something from them, that's even better. And if I walk away from it and being like, well, that didn't really do anything for me conceptually, but like, I got to watch a 90-minute movie, like, hell.
Yeah, and I don't think this will be the last time we talk about research. I think this is just one part of the research conversation, because it's something we'll do at different stages in every project. But yeah, why don't you send us an email at jointhebraintrust@gmail.com in to talk about the ways you research stuff, who your game parents are for different projects. But otherwise,
I would also love, you know, if you sent like voice notes to the email, we could probably just play them instead of reading them and doing all the, save us a step. But also I think that's cool when we just have somebody else's voice in this hour of us talking to one another.
Yeah, let's see if anybody emailed from last time. We have a couple emails and messages about our first episode's topic. We're recording these in batches, so this is the first one since the first episode came out. Hey, Adam, good job on our reboot of our
we're
podcast.
Back,
people
baby.
seem to like it a lot. But I've got a couple of the fire starters that we asked from people. So I'm going to go ahead and read a couple of these here as we end. One that Aaron Lim brought up from Firebrands is the Bantrol system is not at war, which is a pretty all-timer, as Jason Bostwick says, a pretty all-timer fire starter. There is, Jason posts the Electric Bastion Land one, which is really great, that it goes, Bastion, the electric hub of mankind, the only city that matters. Deep country, it stretches forever, the long shadows of our past. In the underground, machines undermine reality. Aliens are here from beneath the living stars. You have a failed career. You have a colossal debt. Treasure is your only hope.
Banging.
I posted Travelers, which is also on the cover. What's up? Respect to my elders putting it on the cover, like I did for Plasmodex. This is the free trader Beowulf calling anyone. Mayday, mayday. We are under attack. Main drive is gone. Turret number one not responding. Mayday. Losing cabin pressure fast. Calling anyone. Please help. This is the free trader Beowulf. Mayday.
I added Summer Camp Island from Cartoon Network.
How does that one go?
Magic is real here, far away from home. Anything can happen when witches make the rules. Monsters are cool. The moon is our friend. I want to stay with you on Summer Camp Island.
That's so cute.
It's amazing, I love that show. But that theme song, which is 40 seconds or whatever, does the same thing. Like, you know about the setting. It's far away from home. There's magic. There's witches. There's monsters, but they're cool. Like, fuck. Like, let's go.
I think that one and the Electric Bastion Line one have a lot in common, which is like, here are the boundaries of the setting with the fire starter.
Should we tease the one in our private text that we are going to address in the future?
Oh, yeah. What was that one?
Born to Die, World is a Fuck, Kill 'em All, 1989, I Am Trash Man, 410,757,864,530 dead cops.
And then a doggy and a rabbit holding hands.
Yeah.
Future, we are going to make that game.
Yep.
On the, maybe the next episode. How about?
I would love that. Yeah.
Great. Yeah, next time we're going to play Storm the Born to Die official role-playing game.
Which I think we almost definitely are going to have to put in some kind of format, like PDF to the Ko-Fi, where you can subscribe and give us tips and help us continue to make the show. That is braintrust.rocks to get linked to the Ko-Fi, to get linked to the Braintrust Discord, both of our publishing websites, and the podcast itself on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Yeah, and I'll close this out with one final fire starter from Clay V on the Brain Trust that is from his campaign last year. So you can write these even for your own game at home, which is great. The Deep. Orange moss glows before you, completely flat and extending past your vision. Thin stalks with barbed hairs reach high as a tempest of pollen slowly drifts down out of the darkness. A strange beast, part metal, skitters away, its clanking retreat heard well after it disappears into the mist. A high menacing hum grows as you feel the presence of a charcoal latency scrape through the recesses of your mind. If there was quiet, you might feel safe. If there was quiet, the deep would certainly catch you sleeping. That's cool.
Yeah, I love
That's really good writing.
I love If There Was Quiet because it just does a lot of heavy lifting to, especially for misophoniacs to be like, this is a stressful world.
Charcoal latency. All right. You've been listening to the Brain Trust podcast. Like Adam said, go check out our Ko-Fi. We really appreciate it. Tips there help us do things like make extra stuff for the show. I spend a lot of time on the music, and you know what? I really like doing it, but it definitely helps if I get some money doing it. You know, it's pretty cool. Okay, so I've been Willie Oaks
and
for the Brain Trust podcast.
Yeah, and I'm Adam. Bye.
Brain emoji, handshake emoji, goodbye. Oh, can we hear from the little Victorian boy before we go?
Thank you so much for the podcast, sirs. I appreciate it.
Fuck out of here. Oh.